From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the pioneers of the underground cinema, George Cuchar. During the 50s and 60s, he made ultra-low-budget films like Hold Me While I'm Naked and Lust for Ecstasy. The films were made in and around the Bronx, featuring what Cuchar described as people who were fat but wanted to be like Marilyn Monroe. A retrospective of Cuchar's films is now being shown in New York City. Also today, Second Sight. We talk with historian Robert Hine about what it was like to lose his sight and then regain it 15 years later. He's written a new memoir. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers when the saxophone, not the guitar, held rock and roll's solo spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NATO ambassadors agreed today on options to launch airstrikes in Bosnia, but bowed to the insistence of several European members that the UN Secretary General have final approval of a first strike. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
A statement issued after the meeting demanded that Bosnian Serbs lift the siege of Sarajevo without delay and that Serb-occupied peaks around the Bosnian capital be put under UN control. But the statement did not set a specific deadline for Serbs to fulfill the demands. It said the ambassadors approved a series of options and that any airstrikes be limited to supporting relief efforts in Bosnia and must not be interpreted as a decision to intervene militarily in the conflict. Sources close to the meeting said strikes should be limited to military needs, restricted to Bosnian territory, and undertaken only if Serbs ignore a clear warning. The decision to give UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali first strike approval is seen as watering down U.S. demands for a tougher Western policy in Bosnia. Boutros-Ghali and UN officials have insisted that airstrikes be carried out only to defend UN peacekeepers on the ground if they come under attack. This is Sylvia Poggioli reporting.
UN officials in Bosnia say that ethnic Serbian troops have withdrawn as promised from one mountain overlooking Sarajevo, but that they have not yet pulled away from another one. The military and political leaders of the Bosnian Serbs promised yesterday that their troops would be withdrawn from newly captured positions on the two mountains. The positions are to be occupied by UN peacekeepers to prevent either side from gaining an advantage. U.S. forces in Somalia are on heightened alert today following the deaths of four American soldiers. The four young men were killed Sunday when the military vehicle they were in hit a bomb on a crowded Mogadishu street. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Colin Powell said in Washington today, "We are interested in going after any of those who are responsible for the incident if we can find out who they are." In the meantime, said the chairman, troops would be taking greater care. The United Nations, in charge of the operation in Somalia, has blamed the landmine detonation yesterday on guerrillas loyal to fugitive Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid. President Clinton has vowed to respond to the killings, the largest loss of life for Americans since troops landed in Somalia last December. As yet, however, no additional forces have been sent into or around Somalia. The Marine Battle Group responsible for the attack on Somalia in June is now out of the area. There are 4,000 U.S. troops on the ground, including 1,200 members of the Quick Reaction Force. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The Dow Industrials gained 16 points to close at a record 3,576. This is NPR. The Clinton administration took steps today to boost grazing fees and tighten controls on ranchers who use federal land. The policy, announced by Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, sidesteps opposition in Congress by changing federal rules that don't require congressional approval. Under the plan, fees to graze on federal land would more than double over a three-year period, but they would still be less than half the average fee charged for grazing on private land. Environmentalists have claimed that low grazing fees encouraged ranchers to overgraze and ignore the long-term health of the land. President Clinton made an appearance in Charleston, West Virginia today to celebrate the passage of his deficit reduction package and to talk about what he'd like to work on once Congress returns from its August recess. Cecilia Mason of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
President Clinton's looking ahead to the next items on his agenda. He told a crowd gathered at the capital of West Virginia that the administration and Congress must now deal with eliminating wasteful government spending, ending welfare as we know it, and passing a crime bill to put more officers on the street.
All these things must be done in a different way, and we need bipartisan support. We need to put an end to the partisan rancor and put the American people first again.
Calling it the greatest continuing threat to the economy and personal security, Clinton emphasized the need for health care reform. He says unless that's done, the deficit will never be eliminated. For National Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Charleston, West Virginia.
13 senators sent a letter to President Clinton today urging the administration to pay the United States back dues to the United Nations. The bipartisan Senate group said the United States risks its credibility with other nations if it fails to pay its bills. The United States is the biggest contributor to the UN, but it's also the biggest debtor. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cheap, crude, lewd, avant-garde home movie versions of Hollywood melodrama. That's the kind of films the Kuchar brothers made in the 50s and 60s in New York City. John Waters once said George and Mike Kuchar influenced him more than anyone. The brothers stopped making films together in 1965. The Museum of the Moving Image in New York City just began a retrospective of George Kuchar's work. The retrospective is called Gossamer Garbage, and will include such underground films as Hold Me While I'm Naked, Lust for Ecstasy, and The Devil's Cleavage, as well as Kuchar's recent video journals. The museum catalog essay describes his work as fueled by the creative tension between Hollywood dreams and everyday realities. As an introduction to his work, I'll let George Kuchar describe his 1966 film, Hold Me While I'm Naked.
The story was, well, actually it was supposed to be a different story. I had my friend Donna Kness, and she was going to act with another woman, Gina Zuckerman. And Gina Zuckerman had gotten a divorce from her husband. I changed her name later to Gina Duval, and she was mad at me for doing that. But it was actually supposed to be about a mother and daughter vying for the attentions of the same man. And it was going to be a big kind of torrid potboiler. And actually, it didn't turn out because Donna got sick. And she had an ailment that caused her face to puff up. So I decided to focus it more on my dilemma, not being able to make a picture, only I changed it around, not the fact that she was ill. And she did appear in the picture, and she didn't look that bad, but you can see her face was swelling a little.
So what was the new storyline?
Well, the new storyline was about my troubles making a picture. And I made it that nobody wanted to be in it because they were asked to take their clothes off instead of, the fact that she was ill. So it became more about a dilemma, about a filmmaker. And also it was about something else. It was about somebody, a person thinking that everyone else is having a good time and they're not, sexually.
Well, right. There's a scene, for instance, in which there's a couple in the shower, very sensual, the water's pouring down on them. And,
right.
And they're in the shower with their clothes on, and of course the bodies are kind of
Coming
through their clothes, beautiful bodies, and they're beginning to make passionate love, and they're slowly stripping. And then the camera cuts away to you in the shower, and you're like, you're taking off your socks, and you're, undoing your baggy pants, and you're stepping into the shower and just washing yourself, and finally just banging your head against the wall.
Right.
A real contrast between, like, ordinary life and this kind of imagined, incredible, tarred relationships everybody else is having.
Right. Well, there was a shot of my buttocks supposed to be in the picture, but I framed it too low, I think. Oh, no. Maybe it was in there, but I thought they looked too big because I was shooting in a wide angle and it was aiming down. So I said, yeah, that looks stinko. So I cut it out just when my underpants started to go down.
Oh, I see. When you're stripping
and
to get
then,
into the shot.
Yeah. But, and then I guess I thought, since the main star, had a colorful cloth wrapped around her like a toga, I would wear one also and add a little mystery to the nudity.
Did you always feel that other people were having more fun than you?
I did. In fact, I thought a lot of other people were much more attractive. And I think it's just the fact that they were not me. So it's something that I always thought about. I suffered through.
You still suffer with it?
Well, I go to a gymnasium now. I work out, so if I have to do a nude scene, I don't look that bad. And then when springtime comes, I try and lay in the sun so I have some color.
You know, that's bad for you now.
I know, that's what I hear, but I think it's a lie. I think it's people want you to stay inside and work in an office.
Well, you've lately been doing video diaries.
Right.
And in some of them, you know, you have very everyday things like a phone call or a dinner. But you have this big dramatic music behind it, investing it with a kind of drama that it wouldn't otherwise have.
Right. Well, you know, I always liked music and pictures. And I had friends that didn't like it because I used to go to a lot of foreign pictures. They didn't have so much music. But, you know, I know in opera, you got music running all the way through and no one says, you know, turn the music off. There's too much music. So I always did enjoy music.
And when did you start making diaries?
I made it about 8 years ago. So I think I started 8 years ago with 8mm. So I went back to sort of the size that I started with in movies, because I started in 8mm movies. So I bought myself a Sony 8mm camera, and I still have it, 8 years. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, a lot of filmmakers were looking at me and looking at that thing and thinking it was a cheap plastic toy, and I was wasting my time with this thing. But I liked it. It was like a friend. I took it on vacations, and it stayed by my bed. I made sure it didn't get wet, and it was like a little intelligence.
Did you go to the movies a lot as a kid?
I did. I used to go a great deal with my brother, and we liked the early Roger Corman movies. I had liked them because the people in it were, they were professional, but they wound up in such a lousy project, like Cheap, that it was so interesting to see adults behaving in such a way, you know what I mean, in such an incompetence. So I thought it was sort of very encouraging and not so frightening to grow up, if that's what it was like. So I very much enjoyed that. Also, it took it away from the illusion. You knew that you were watching a picture, and I sort of liked that double thing going on in the movie theater.
What else did you like?
Well, I used to see the dramas, the Douglas Sirk dramas, and I thought those were real professional, like adults working and doing an excellent job. So that was very inspiring, and it had very good music and cinematography.
Oh, and it had these big emotional themes.
Right, very big. And I sort of loved the kind of language, the Hollywood language. Even it was a German man. He's a German man, but he made such beautiful Hollywood imagery with his crew.
What about war films, monster films, westerns?
Well, war films I used to go to, I never really enjoyed them. There wasn't enough women in them. And I liked them if there was a lot of women in it, and it showed the soldiers, you know, being with their women. And then it showed what the women were doing back in the city, you know, when they were gone. And I used to go to westerns, and I never really cared for them. But it's just something you go to. When I was younger, you know, the westerns were out. And I never really, the rocks and everything had no meaning to me. And it isn't until now, till recently, I went to Arizona and I saw how beautiful and big those rocks are. It's quite a wonderful world. And now I want to see the westerns that I saw in my youth, because I realize the rocks are beautiful.
And monster films?
Well, monster films I love so much because they are the most realistic pictures around.
How so?
Because they deal with the true issues of your inner self. And they're able to do that without trying to make it look realistic. They don't have to try and be real because they only look phony anyway. So what they do is they get more at the pictures seem to get more at the core of troubles, inner troubles and, you know, things about life. So I found them very, very mature on a level of, like, being human.
So after getting very involved with the movies you were seeing at the local theaters, what was the home like that you came back to?
Well, when I was here living in New York and in the Bronx, is that you went to work, and of course it was miserable, and they boss you around, and you get on that subway, and it's crowded. The only time the subway is fun is in the morning because everyone's horny. So once in a while, you know, somebody reaches out and grabs you and stuff like that. But in
it's a woman's nightmare. Well, this is what made the subway horrible.
I used to look forward to those moments, you know.
But then when somebody grabbed you.
But then, you know, those things happen not that often. And so it's mainly just a crush. But then late in the day, none of that happens. Everybody's so tired. It's just, you know, a train of people coming home and they're very tired. And then you go home and you bring home a cake because there's nothing else to come home to. And so, of course, you gain weight and goes on and on like that. And you get old real fast.
What was home like when home was your mother's house?
Well, she was cooking a lot, and then you had to be there on time, and she liked you to eat the food hot. So there was always that tension, you better get to the table right away, or there's going to be trouble. And she's a very nice woman, you know. But, of course, she was married, and that had its rough spots. And my dad had a very good porno collection, and he read all kinds of sexy books. So I used to read the literature that he had.
Do you have, like, an 8mm porno collection?
Well, he did. He was a truck driver. And they had the notorious red reels. They used to circulate it among the men there. And then he would come into the room and say, you got your 8mm projector? Can I borrow it? I said, okay. But I said, what do you got? He's going to have a movie, and I want to see it. So I got interested, and he would say, okay, you can see it after me. So I would play it.
So did his collecting of 8mm pornography help you get a sense of the technology, or did you have your film stuff before he started watching it?
I had my film stuff before, but sometimes I used to re-photograph those movies and put it into some of my stories.
You know,
A bunch of people were watching like a porno picture. And but I already had interest in movies going on already.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that instead of making your ambition going to Hollywood, your ambition was more to bring some of the stuff of Hollywood drama into the ordinariness of your life.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I go to Hollywood, but, you know, you need a car in Hollywood. And also it's a very, like, sex-charged place. And people are under a lot of tension, and that's why there's so much hanky-panky going on. And I can't work very well in a group where there's money at stake, because I know that we're going to lose money. And I'm not very good at meetings, and I like just tackling something. And also, when you work with actors, they want to know exactly what the characterizations are all about and this and that, and I just don't know. Sometimes we start from scratch, and we just invent it on the spot. So I think I wouldn't fit in very well. I would get the company into trouble and just be a pain in the neck.
Uh-huh. But you've enjoyed bringing a touch of Hollywood drama into your day-to-day life?
Oh, yeah, it's true. And then, you know, when you relive it in your head, it is like a drama, because this is your story of your life. And then if you can actually put it on film or make paintings of it, you're actually, you know, sharing it with other people. But since we see movies so much in television, it's probably just, see, I think it's even constructed like that in your head, you know.
My guest is George Kuchar. His underground films of the 60s and 70s and his recent video journals are being shown in a retrospective of his work at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York City. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Independent filmmaker George Kuchar is my guest. You're one of the pioneers of independent films. How did you start making your own? I mean, how did you and your brother first get a camera?
Well, in the early days, my aunt and my mom were on talking terms, barely. And my aunt had a camera. And so she would loan it to us and we'd take pictures. And then when they had a falling out, my aunt and my mom bought us a camera, so that we would, you know, wouldn't have to go see her. And so we started on making our pictures. And then when we were showing in the American avant-garde, the underground showcases here that Jonas Mekas was having, and at that time Warhol was beginning to make pictures, that time we saw 16mm pictures and said, oh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe we should get a 16mm camera because we're working out. My brother and I are working. So my brother was going to buy a fountain. It was a fountain that dripped water, and it looked like a science fiction type of thing. And instead of spending the $500 on that, he bought a 16mm camera. And we started making 16mm movies. And then the people who had seen our pictures in 8mm, the other filmmakers thought, like, well, 8mm is something, and they were switching to 8 and were sort of shocked that we had gone into 16.
How did you find your early stars?
Well, they were friends of ours, and we had very few girlfriends. So my brother and I and some other friends used to switch roles. We would play the female parts and the male part. And then we had really no backgrounds, and we wanted to make exotic pictures like at Atlantis or Egyptian things. So we used to go on the roof where there was just black tar walls, And then at the time on television during that period, they used to have avant-garde plays where a whole thing would be played out against a black stage with maybe just a stepladder in there. So we thought, well, that's a kind of style. So maybe people can fill in the background if we have the costumes on. So we used to go up on the roof and take the camera and try to do it fast before my mother came home from work because we borrowed her drapes and her clothing and stuff. And she would catch us up there. It would be a horrible scene. We'd get beatings, and it was considered a shame and a disgrace. Plus, we used to throw dummies off the roof, you know, for when things had to happen, you know, like special effects and stuff. And the neighbors, you know, was wondering what was going on. So in a way, it was kind of considered a shame. And then we thought it was such a shame, we burned those early films.
You did?
Yeah. And there's very little left from that real early period.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, it's gone.
Oh. So when did you start actually getting women in your movies so you and your brother didn't have to dress as women?
Well, we had these tomboy-type girls, and they were very nice, and they liked taking big, long walks, and then we would dress them up. We'd put on... I started, I guess, my makeup career. I became later known as Mr. Dominic in some of my movies. And at that time, there used to be a man going on television, and he had... stencils of how you can do your eyebrows. You put a stencil on your face and you do eyebrows. And I thought that was so interesting, so I got the idea to let's do makeup. And I always thought that that was kind of interesting. Before you know, go in front of the camera, you had the whole process of being redone and made up and stuff like that. So we used to put makeup on them, and then it sort of spread out. And then when we began showing pictures in the 8mm showcase places, we would meet people in the audience who wanted to be in the movies. And, you know, like friends and wives of other filmmakers, and we'd have them in pictures. So it began branching out.
When you started making movies, you were working with your twin brother.
Right.
Did being twins add a little extra drama to your lives?
Well, actually, I don't know if you ever saw that picture. It's a horror movie, Basket Case.
Yes.
Well, that's a very good inkling of the psychology between twins. And... it's very accurate. And so it has its upside, but it also has its downside. And it's got strange twisted alleys as far as, like, mental thinking.
What are some of those strange twisted alleys?
Well, it's hard to actually go into it right, you know what I mean, on the air here. Well, in other words, there are strange... You don't know if jealousy will come in and suddenly... If maybe you're doing something to cripple the other half of you, you know what I mean, which it would be your brother, you're not sure if you're responsible for maybe crippling them in some way and causing something going wrong. And then you're not sure if you should bring certain people over the house because would the person feel bad, your other half, you know? And it's very similar to that movie, Basket Case.
Did this have anything to do with why you stopped making movies together?
No, not at all, because my brother and I have been living together for 51 years. And we were very much friends. But we also have to not know. We know about each other, but then we have to not know too much.
How did you start getting your films screened?
Well, we used to shoot in, like, friends' houses, and then the following week they would have a party. And we would bring our film to show what we had made there, and that became our showcase. Then I started to meet these older people, and instead of being very dead kind of old people, they were like 10, 15 years older than me, they were real kind of crazy. This was, I guess, in the 60s, and they sort of were kind of wild and crazy. They were fooling around one another, and they were thinking kind of different. So I was introduced to them by my star, Donna Caness. We went to high school together. And I saw that, well, gee, these are strange people. We began making movies with them, and then they were in tune more with what was happening, like in the underground movies and in the art world here. And they said, why don't we go and see these pictures here? I want you to see some of these movies. And it was at the Charles Theater where they were playing 16mm underground movies. And then we were asked to show our movies at one of those showcases. And I think it was a loft, Ken Jacobs' loft. And the movies seemed to be a hit. And a lot of the people from that, you know, culture kind of area came. And the movies were asked to come next, the following week. And Jonas Mekas came and wrote about it in his column in the Village Voice. And we began to be something on the regular circuit of the underground movies. And we began meeting these other artists and stuff. And I always thought, you know, to get into a museum and to be, you know, noted like that, you'd have to be dead. And instead, these doors began opening, and you began meeting these artists, and they took you as one of them. But then they, we had other friends, you know, worked in the post office and stuff, and I know the artists used to tell me, one of them did, that, oh, you have friends that work in the post office? He said, those are the real people. So in a way, those artists, they felt like they were like an outsiders or something.
So for, I guess about 23 years, you've been teaching at the San Francisco Art Institute?
Right.
And do you use your students in your cast?
Well, yeah, sometimes I befriend my students. In fact, I hardly befriend the faculty. I think we repel each other. We, you know, nod, this and that, we talk, we go to meetings. And it's actually kind of civilized. But I actually make friends with the students. For some reason, I forget the age difference. It doesn't seem to matter. Maybe I seem to be think I'm young again until I just look at myself on the screen, you know. But in school, we have a workshop, and the name of the class, they were thinking of changing all the class names to attract students, so I picked ACDC Psychotronic Teleplays, because I was shooting not only in film, I couldn't shoot so much, our budget was only $1,000 to make a production, and I was putting in too much money of my own to bail out our projects. I would put in $1,000 of my own money every semester. So I decided I would shoot in video, you know, commit the sin and bring the video camera into the film classroom. And we're shooting film, video. They're welcome to bring in their still cameras, also Polaroids, anything that they want. We do drawings. And they alternate as far as they get a chance to do sets, you know, act, maybe direct the scene. You want to write a part here and there. And I oversee the whole production.
Mm-hmm.
I give them the whole idea. And then from there, we jump off and they put in their, you know, feed into the project, their ideas. And then we try to make something that can hit the screen and somebody on the outside world will maybe find a value. And so every semester we turn out a production. And I usually screen it with some of my own stuff.
One last question.
Yeah.
The music, the big dramatic music that you
right.
use in your films, do you get them from recordings?
Yeah, it's from records. And I had a big collection of records, and occasionally I go to used record stores and pick them up. Sometimes they're $2.50, or sometimes $3, a whole bunch of things.
And ever get sued?
No, never. You know, most of my stuff, see, I do everything wrong. Everything that I do is wrong, because I found if you do it right, it costs too much money. And so, you know, it's all wrong. People never sign releases in the picture, and there's never any kind of thing like that. In fact, they're, you know, probably completely backward, and it's the, sort of the way I work. Eventually, they fall apart. Even the movies that spliced wrong. So I found that the only way I can do it is to do it wrong.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
All right. Well,
thanks.
Good luck, and thanks for the interest in my work.
George Kuchar's film retrospective, Gossamer Garbage, continues at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York City through September 5th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, going blind and then 15 years later, seeing again. We talk with historian Robert Hine. He gradually lost his sight and then overnight regained it in one eye. Hine says the way he thought and the way he experienced time and space were different when he was blind. He's written a new memoir called Second Sight. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers rock and roll's early saxophonists, Lee Allen, King Curtis, and Steve Douglas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Bosnia, Serbian forces have pulled out of one key mountain region near the capital, but failed to start withdrawal from another. Yesterday, the Bosnian Serb commander agreed to pull out of the mountain positions in a deal brokered by the United Nations. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Sarajevo.
French peacekeepers monitored the Bosnian Serb withdrawal from Mount Belenica today. Overcast skies prevented the UN troops from getting a full picture of the Serbian redeployment. It was the first steps in an agreement designed to kickstart peace talks about the future of Bosnia-Herzegovina in Geneva. The Bosnian Serbs still occupy positions on Mount Igman. Mount Igman is the more militarily significant of the two mountains. It overlooks the city of Sarajevo and completes the encirclement of the capital. The Bosnian government army used Mount Igman as an armed supply route. The Bosnian Serbs captured the mountain last week while negotiating an agreement to cease all hostilities. UN officials say that monitors will continue to clear mines from the mountain and report on Bosnian Serb deployments. In Sarajevo, this is Deborah Amos.
NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels have called on Serbian factions in Bosnia to stop their siege of Sarajevo immediately. A statement also called on Serb-occupied mountains around the capital of Bosnia to be put under UN control. It was also announced that a series of options have been agreed upon, including possible airstrikes by NATO planes. However, that step would have to have the approval of UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The PLO is trying to resolve an open conflict between its leadership and the Palestinian delegation to the Middle Eastern peace talks. Emergency talks are being held in Tunis following reports that three delegates are on the verge of resigning. Jackie Rowland reports from Tunis.
Tension between the PLO in Tunis and negotiators in the occupied territories has been building up for several months. Members of the negotiating team are said to be angry with the PLO leader Yasser Arafat for being too quick to compromise on Palestinian demands in the hope of winning Israeli recognition for the PLO. Reports have been circulating since yesterday that three delegation members, Faisal Husseini, Hanan Ashrawi and Saeb Erekat, want to resign. The three delegates have had discussions in Tunis with Arafat, but they are refusing to comment on the resignation rumors. As a sign that the crisis is not yet over, the PLO leadership has called other members of the delegation to Tunis for talks that are expected to last at least 24 hours. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 15.5 points to close at 3,576.08, a record high, on volume of 232 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. A U.S. diplomat was killed yesterday in the capital of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Officials say that Fred Woodruff was shot and killed by a lone gunman while driving with a bodyguard for Georgian leader Eduard Shevardnadze. The bodyguard was not injured. The attack came after the United States decided to step up its mediation efforts in trouble spots in the former Soviet Union. Last week, government officials said that they might impose a state of emergency because of widespread lawlessness brought on by several years of unrest. Negotiators for the United States, Canada, and Mexico failed to reach agreement on side issues to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The negotiators wrapped up 10 days of talks with a terse joint statement. They described the talks as intensive negotiations. There are a handful of remaining issues. Officials will continue to work this week in order to address these issues. According to sources close to the talks, the three countries remain deadlocked over the U.S. insistence on trade sanctions against violators of labor and environmental laws. The negotiators are also discussing proposals to fund border pollution cleanup and infrastructure development. Earlier today, the negotiators put out a statement denying a Canadian report that a deal had been struck that would break the deadlock. The report said the deal would exempt Canada from sanctions, but not Mexico or the United States. The Clinton administration must conclude the side agreement talks before submitting NAFTA to Congress. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Somalia, UN forces have been placed on heightened alert after a landmine attack over the weekend that killed four American soldiers. UN officials now in charge of aid operations in Somalia have blamed the blast on gunmen tied to fugitive clan leader General Adid. Spokesmen for Adid have denied responsibility for the attack. UN helicopters are now flying low over main transportation roads in efforts to prevent another attack. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Robert Hine was 20, his doctor told him to prepare to lose his sight. He lost it gradually over the next 30 years to a degenerative eye disease. Hine is a history professor. When he could no longer see, he turned to Braille. He adapted from library research to oral history. He devised a system to keep track of the students he could no longer see. After 15 years in the dark, vision in one eye was restored through an operation. Hine has written a new memoir called Second Sight about what it was like to go blind and then to see again. I asked him to describe the first time he saw his wife after 15 years. I figured he had kept a visual image of her that hadn't aged during the years he was blind.
Well, you know, that was true with most people, Terry. I felt that 15 years of aging when I would see the face again. But with my wife, strangely enough, it didn't happen. I don't know whether my wife didn't age as much or whether the fact that I was always so close to her meant that I kept up with her changes. Her hair was completely white by the time I got my sight back, and it had not been white when I was blind. But she was always very blonde, very light, and the blondness to the whiteness didn't seem to change that much. And I felt, you know, Shirley's face was so close to me. I didn't feel it of the vibrations there, or I didn't feel the shock of a change that I did with so many other people. My daughter, for example, who had 15 years when you're young, makes much more difference. I get much more of a difference than it does when you're older.
Yeah, she went from a teenager to a mature mother of two.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us what it was like the first time you opened your eyes after the operation and you could see?
Oh, it was just so wonderful. I can never tell you fully how great that was. I was in a doctor's office, of course, and surrounding me were all these shining instruments and bottles of colored medications. And of course, the first thing I saw was the nurse, just because she was there when the bandages came off. And she looked, she moved away a bit, and she looked very strange to me. You don't see at first as you should, you know. I hope everyone understands that it takes a while to learn to see. The fact that the light is coming in properly through your eyeball does not mean that you're going to see. You've got the brain and the whole pathways, and everything has to adjust so that what you see at first is very distorted. I remember thinking that nurse, she had a white pants uniform on, that she looked like a spaceman, like those images that I had remembered of the landings on the moon. But then when I saw my wife right beside her, it was so beautiful. Shirley had worn a blouse that day of banded color. I've never asked her whether that was deliberate or not, but the first thing I did after I saw her and we smiled was to point to those colors and name them for her: yellow, blue, red. Those things are so exciting, you simply can't begin to describe them.
Did you go through any surprising depressions after your surgery? I'm sure everybody assumed you should be elated all the time. I don't know if you really were.
No, you're quite right. There are times when you're not so sure about the change. For one thing, you realize, or you come to realize, that as a sort of professional person, that as a blind man, you have been given certain privileges. You've been deferred to, and you've been you wonder if maybe some of your accomplishments were based on the fact that people realized you were blind. And are you going to have those deferences and those privileges and those advantages now that you're sighted again? That's a real worry, I think, with people who get their sight back. What is this whole new world going to do to you, or going to demand of you, that it was not demanding while you were blind?
What was your first thought when you looked in the mirror and you saw yourself 15 years older than when you'd last seen your face?
That was not very happy, I can certainly tell you that. Not only the mirror, but your whole body. The hair on my arms, for example, just looked awful. You see, this is also a part of the fact that you're not seeing well at first. You're seeing distortedly. The veins in your hand just look awful. They look, you just look like you're 1,000 years old, and coming out of those Hilton pictures of Shangri-La, remember when they get back into the real world and they all turn into sort of mummies again? You had that sort of feeling when you looked at yourself, at least I did. Mouths looked weird and eyes were all strange. And of course, I had lost a lot of hair in those years, and so I had an enormous forehead that I hadn't remembered before. That's not easy, seeing yourself again after 15 years.
My guest is Robert Hine. He's the author of the new book Second Sight, which is about how he went blind at the age of 50 and then through surgery regained sight in one eye 15 years later. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Hine, author of the new book, Second Sight. You say that you developed an excessive interest in the human body after you regained your sight, and a new excitement in sex. I guess those two were connected.
Yes, I think so.
Did you find that you had kind of taken for granted before the visual aspect of sexuality?
Well, I think I learned what perhaps most people know, that that sight is awfully important in sex. The vision of a beautiful woman is not unrelated, certainly, to sexual excitement. But I suppose we always assume that and properly so, that's not the whole story. But the question is whether vision, whether sight is, how important it is to sex. And I just felt very deeply that I learned again that it is a very important thing, that it's not just perfume and sounds, soft music and so on that are important, but other things.
Did your dreams change in the period, you know, when you were blind and when you regained your sight? Did you see in your dreams when you were blind?
Yes, the question of color in blindness, color in dreams and in blindness is fascinating. One of the things that happens after your sight comes back, or did happen to me, is you see things that are kind of like dreams, even constantly. In your sighted vision, for instance, you get great color fields that sort of roll in these great like waves of beautiful color. And or you get little animation. I remember little figures hopping around like little gnomes all around the landscape. And I'm told that that's fairly frequent with the return of sight, that the visual images that your brain and your mechanisms are reestablishing have to go through a series of forms like this, and you get them repeated so that in the morning when you're just waking up, for example, I remember those days in which these visual fields would roll over my sight, either eyes closed or open. They were beautiful. They were wonderful. I suppose it was like those color fields being replenished after the years of no feeding them in the brain.
In your book, you write that when you were blind, some people magnified every little ordinary act into a deed of courage. I mean, you could be washing the dishes and people would say, "Isn't that amazing? Isn't he special?" Did that feel like high praise to you when you were blind? Did you find that patronizing or appreciate that? And did you continue to get any kind of really great feedback after you had sight, you know?
I think it is patronizing, and I think the blind generally do resent that kind of thing. It's true that that blindness is a. I've sometimes said that the blind are the darlings of the handicapped. They get rewards, and they get an income tax deduction, for example, that nobody else gets, and. They're very special as handicapped people, and that's sometimes not very good for the blind themselves. I think the blind, in all the writings of blind people that I've done in the last few years, it seems to me the ones who are most excited about their lives are ones who have been made to do things as if they were not blind, who have been treated as if they were not blind. They are the ones who feel less that difference.
Well, one more question. What gives you the most pleasure now of the things that you can do now that you couldn't do when you were blind?
Oh, I guess reading the newspaper in the morning with my wife beside me and... talking about it and spooning that grapefruit and knowing where the grapefruit is going and buttering your roll so that you get the butter where you want it and the amount you want rather than having to test it on your tongue or something like that. There's so many things like that, Terry. I could go on all day.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Terry. I appreciate this lots.
Robert Heine's new memoir is Second Sight. Heine is a professor of history emeritus at the University of California, Riverside. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams, All Things Considered in Washington, with a word about our program coming up. We'll have conversations about Somalia, talking with a former ambassador to Kenya and a Somali native who served as an interpreter for the U.S. forces serving there back in February. NPR's Deborah Amos reports on the latest developments in Sarajevo. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt announces increased grazing fees for ranchers on federal land in the American West, and a conversation with Liz Phair, a young Chicago songwriter. She had her video debut this past weekend on MTV, and she talks with us about the process of writing, how she sees harmonies in visual terms. And that and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. ¶¶
Up until the Beatles and the Beach Boys turned the focus of rock and roll to the guitar, the solo instrumental spot in a record was almost always taken by a tenor saxophone. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says there were a slew of unsung heroes who played those thousands of solos. Some are still unknown today, but he has a tribute to some of the identifiable standouts.
Raphael Ravenscroft, now there's a name that's been forgotten, except perhaps by his mother. But his sax introduction to Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street is probably what sold the record. It's probably the part you remember best. Still, listening to some recent records the other night, I found myself lamenting the current state of rock and roll saxophone. They don't play it like they used to.
Well, I saw him walk the door with bald head Sally. He saw Mary coming and he ducked back in the alley, oh, baby.
Just as Earl Palmer, the drummer on Little Richard's classic recordings, invented rock and roll drumming, the great Lee Allen virtually invented the rock and roll saxophone break. In rhythm and blues, which derive from urban blues, the vocalist was the center of attention, with guitar and saxophone solos being mostly textural changes to break up the monotony of the minimal accompaniment. And with the exception of Chuck Berry, early rock and roll was mostly not guitar-centered, so it was the saxophone that got the solo slot.
I'm walking, yes indeed, I'm talking, but you and me, I'm hoping that you come back to me.
Allen had been born in Kansas, but moved to New Orleans to go to school and began working with Paul Gayton and Dave Bartholomew, the city's two top band leaders, in the late 40s. Because nearly every R&B and rock and roll record cut in New Orleans had members of one or the other of those bands on it, Allen practically lived in the studio, and his sound was so distinctive that it wound up setting the standards for rock and roll saxophone. His main competition throughout the 50s was a Texas kid named Curtis Owsley, whom you probably know better as King Curtis.
You just put on your coat and hat and walk yourself to the laundromat. And when you finish doing that, bring in the dog and put out the cat. Yak-a-yak.
Don't hold back.
Coasters' Yakety Yak was the record that made King Curtis. In fact, it's hard to imagine the Coasters without him. But he was already a seasoned pro by 1958 when it came out. He'd left Fort Worth with the Lionel Hampton Band and stayed in New York, where he became an important session musician, recording with Nat Cole, Big Joe Turner, Laverne Baker, and many other early R&B stars. Curtis also saw wider horizons. In 1960, he cut a couple of jazz albums with some of Miles Davis's musicians and held his own among them. But for bread and butter, he continued to record as a sideman for Atlantic Records, and you can hear him on sessions he worked on right up to the day a deranged neighbor stabbed him to death on his front stoop in New York. Allen and King Curtis at least got respect, but the vast majority of rock and roll saxophonists labored anonymously, a fact that was brought home to me when I read of Steve Douglas's death earlier this year. I had the good fortune to see him play, with Lee Allen, in fact, a couple of years ago. He picked up the saxophone, put it in his mouth, and pinned the audience against the far wall. Nothing subtle here. Although he's not in any of my reference books, I do know that Douglas's real name was Stephen Kreisman, and that, in addition to convincing Duane Eddy to record Peter Gunn, he played on recordings by the Beach Boys. He was a regular at L.A.'s famous Gold Star Studios, so he's in the Wall of Sound on many of Phil Spector's classics, and probably legions of forgettable records as well. There are too many of these forgotten men to mention here, but let me pay my respects to Herb Hardesty, whom we heard on that Fats Domino track as second sax, to Plaz Johnson, who played every L.A. session Steve Douglas didn't, to Hank Cosby and Kasuku Mafie at Motown, and to the guy who woke up just long enough to play the break on Angel Baby by Rosie and the Originals.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with blues guitarist Buddy Guy. Also, the ridiculous but true story of Louie Louie, the song the FBI kept a file on to investigate whether the lyrics were as dirty as teenagers and parents thought they were. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.